You can, in a sense, especially when you've got those prepared in your head. You've got to have...
The negative thoughts are still coming. The strategies you've got to use against them can be ingrained. But when they come, you manage it.
This is Running for Real, the podcast for runners who know that for every runner's high, there are just as many lows. All those just missed PRs, easy runs that feel hard, injury blues, and more. Each week, we'll talk to running, health, and wellness experts about their highs, lows, and best advice to build our confidence. Running for Real is about being honest, being brave, and most of all, not feeling alone. And now here's our host, who loves a cheesy quote, Tina Muir.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to this bonus episode of the Running for Real podcast. Were you expecting to see me on a Monday? Probably not. Or maybe you were if you were a member of the Running for Real Superstars and you knew it was coming. But if you are surprised, then I'm going to tell you why that is in just a second. But if you are getting this automatically, I want to thank you because that means you are subscribed to the Running for Real podcast. If you are not subscribed, this is a great time to sign up because these bonus episodes will be coming out once a month from now on and they won't catch you off guard. If you are subscribed, they will come to you automatically. Even if you don't want to listen to a particular episode, it's easy to delete. But if they go right to you, not only are they right there if you need them, but that also helps me because the more subscribers I have, the better. All right, so why do you have this episode today? Well, this is a bonus episode as we have reached over 500 a month from your support on Patreon for me. Because of your generosity, I promised you that if we reached 500, you'd get a bonus episode every month. So here's the first installment for you. Thank you so much to everyone who is supporting me on Patreon. And for those who don't know, Patreon is a secure website, don't worry, where you can pay a small amount every month. You can even do custom amounts if you really want to give me $3.65 or whatever it may be. But it will just allow you to show your appreciation for all that I do through the podcast, this podcast Running for Real, the Tina for Real podcast, which is my daily podcast, the Running for Real Superstars community, my blog, my emails I send out, and my social media. It just helps me to keep on doing this. And so if you are interested in learning more about Patreon, you can go to patreon.com/runningforreal. That's patreon.com/runningforreal. Or there's plenty of links on my website. So last week we heard from Dean Karnazes, the one and only, and how good of a conversation was that? I actually re-listened to that one. I don't usually re-listen to the episodes because it feels a bit, I don't know, self-righteous. But this one, I was like, did I really build it up in my head as that good of a conversation or was it that good of a conversation? And I wanted to re-listen and I did. And Dean was just amazing the way he shared things with us. He was so real with us and absolutely loved that episode. So if you did miss that one, be sure to go back and check that one out. Now, as this is a bonus episode, I wanted to make it about a topic I know we can never get enough of, the psychology of running. It's funny how we spend so much of our time training our bodies and pushing our bodies, I should say. But training the mind is actually much more difficult than we think, and you can't just fit it into your day. Or am I the only one that actually struggles to get the mental side of things into my day? Even a 3-minute meditation with Headspace, I cannot find the time to get in. I know it's not that I can't find the time, I'm just too lazy to find the time. But anyway, I digress. But it's also knowing what to do and how much to do. It can feel like our minds are trying to sabotage us a lot of the time. And especially when we really want something, you know, we can really struggle mentally. Now, I found this sports psychology couple to bring on the podcast to ask more of the questions that we've always wanted to know. And today I have Helen and Andy Lane to give us some strategies about how to address negative thoughts when they come in during races. We're going to talk about eating disorders and how we are so linked to our emotions when it comes to eating. And as much as we wish it wasn't the case, we often emotionally eat, and we're going to discuss that. Andrew Lane is a professor of sports psychology at the University of Wolverhampton and has a real interest in emotion, which we talk about today. And I always am fascinated in learning about emotion. And Dr. Helen Lane has a PhD in sport and exercise psychology, and she's authored several articles, included a commonly used measure of mood called the Brunel Mood Scale. And she's also done a version of the Eating Attitude Test. So we're going to learn more about that today. Let's go and meet Helen and Andy, and we will be right to the episode. Helen, Andy, thank you so much for joining me today on the Running Freel podcast. I am really excited to dive in and talk about this, especially as you are a couple. This is pretty cool to be able to talk about. So thanks for being here today.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Yeah,
this is going to be fun. Okay, so I have to start with that because, you know, what comes to mind to me when I think about you both being, you know, involved in the psychology world is... I would love to hear the story of how you both met, because I bet that has to be an interesting one.
Yeah, okay. We met on a ski trip at university in 1990. Now, I was not the best of skiers. Right? And I lost my sun cream on one of my 783 falls on the first day, believing that I could get away with it. I didn't apply anymore, and I had a very, very sunburnt face. So in the bar, our lecturer, who ended up being my PhD supervisor in the end, Peter Terry, said, this is Andy to Helen. He used to be a boxer. So there I was with I was known as the reptile by the time of that point. My face was – I had this peeling face, and in a sport that what did you think of the sport of boxing, Helen?
I didn't like it.
I don't really like it.
I didn't think he'd be very interesting. But then he said he was a vegetarian. Then I thought, oh, you know, there's other bits to him, not just a boxer. I had a generalisation of what a boxer's personality is like.
Yeah, I have to say, a vegetarian doesn't go with that, does it?
No. And then when we were finished the first year, he was talking about triathlons, and I thought I would always love to have done triathlons. And I walked to the end of the platform going home to Stockwell, the centre of London, and he said, I'll send you some stuff so you can go to one of the triathlons. And I didn't do it in the summer at all. But the next year we got together and we started going to these triathlons. And I'm not a fast runner or a fast swimmer or a fast cyclist, but it was through running and university that's how we got together.
I actually went through and sent her the stuff, you see. So when we next met, she said, "You sent me the stuff.
This is the day."
And I said, "Of course I sent you the stuff. I said I would."
This is back in the day.
Well, no, I never have plans. It's all hope. It's a hope for the best, everything.
But this is back in the day. If you wanted to enter a race, you had to send off for the application form.
Oh, yeah.
They would send it back to you if you wanted, and you had to pay your money, I think in cash or by check. And if you wanted the results, you had a stamped address envelope. There was no internet. Mm-hmm. And also, even the London Marathon was like that. You had to go down to the local sports shop and collect an application form and come back and fill it in. Wow. And I did the Stockholm Marathon that year, one of my first marathons, and it was all the same. You sent off and came back and... Anyway,
I do remember sending off entry forms to enter races, but I also remember waiting for Athletics Weekly to come out so that I could see results in there because, there was no way of knowing and you'd have to wait for those listening in America, Athletics Weekly is, I guess you would call it a running magazine. It's a track and field athletics magazine, but they'd have like features. And then at the end, it was just pages and pages and pages of results. And so I do remember that part. So it is, but I completely forgot that existed, that we did used to not have the internet to enter races and look up races.
Our relationship blossomed in and after circuit training, which the university did.
Yeah.
So we used to have a circuit training thing, which everybody went to. We used to go to that. And then
the athletic club, someone from the athletic club put it on and it was free. And
yeah, so it starts like that.
That's funny. And you were both studying psychology at that point?
We were doing sport studies degrees. Okay. And at that point, I was a year above.
Okay.
Then I did a PGCE and then we both did the master's degree at the same time. I was a school teacher, and Helen told me that I had to go and do an MSc. So I said, I should do more teaching.
Yeah, actually, and it was so far back that there were very few courses that actually did sports studies.
Yeah, sure.
And we did our MSc straight up. I pushed them to do the MSc, and I did a part-time PGCE. So we ended up there together. But on the MSCs, there was probably only one other, probably only Loughborough, which did them.
There was no one was doing it. Nowhere and, at all was doing part-time.
Not yet. And so we were on the year that they were still validating it. So we did those, didn't we?
Yeah.
We both did our MSCs.
Very interesting.
Anyways.
No, that's cool to hear. And just for clarification with anyone in the US, those are all obviously qualifications that are used in Britain to kind of differentiate what you're doing. PGCE is primarily around teaching, and your MSc is your master's, correct?
Yep. Right,
so, okay. So, Helen, I'm going to have to get you to explain. I obviously know where you are from, but tell everyone listening where you're from and how you ended up in the UK.
Oh, I'm from New Zealand. Mm-hmm. I used to do running when I was a child. My mum used to run marathons. So this was in the 70s. And so she used to drag us along to the Harrier Club. And I hated it. But we all did it. And so that was okay. And anyway, I came to New Zealand, did a lot of travelling, came to England and got the first sort of gardening job I could get, and I knew that I had to go back and go to university, and I was going to go back to Australia, but it started earlier in England, starts in September, whereas it starts in February in Australia. Mm. And so I started my degree in England. And so it was very good.
Yep, which is pretty much the same thing as happened to me, but in the US. Okay, and then just one more thing about the two of you. Do you ever find yourself kind of analysing each other? Like, let's say you make a decision. That's the one thing I've always wondered with, psychology, or even just, couples who are runners, but particularly you two. Do you ever find yourself kind of saying, hey, you're doing this, and then, some technical psychological term, or do you kind of both leave each other alone in that aspect?
Well, I would never, never say about Andy anything he does is not right. And if he gives me some advice, I probably don't listen to it. I know he's right. I don't listen to it. Whereas probably if I hear more from someone like, I don't know, I listen to it more carefully if it's from someone like, I don't know, Martin Yelling or do you know what I mean? It's just because if it's your husband, you probably...
you go, yeah, yeah, all right, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool.
But he's the boss. You're the knowledgeable one, aren't you?
Don't know about that, but you get trapped in the event, don't you? Mm. So you might be the expert, you're still trapped in the event, so it's... You do need to hold back when you're giving advice out. And it's difficult to take advice as well, however well intended it is.
Okay, and I kind of can see that being the case now. Now that I've asked the question and heard your responses, so all right. So Andy, let's kind of start with you. You've authored more than 100 peer-reviewed journal articles. Mm-hmm. Is there anything in particular during the work in those that stood out to you when it comes to runners or kind of the way that we are as humans with regards to the way we view ourselves or how our, psychological mind works?
Right. There's a few things there. An interesting observation early on from the research terms was the powerful impact of sad or depressed thoughts on psychological state and how that then informs how hard people try and performance. And that's quite one of the most remarkable findings we had was that a small bit of depression has such an important effect on the overall mood state. And we've looked at that in all sorts of different sports and contexts, including running, and how it involves with training over time. So as people, if they start going into a spiral of overtraining or poor adaption, small indices of a small mark of depression can lead to all sorts of devastating or negative effects that go on from that. And unless people are very good at self-help, but self-help or knowing what to do to change that, they can get quite down.
So you mean, you know, let's say someone is struggling with, I don't know, maybe a loved one passed away. And if they have a race coming up, that could interfere? Or are you saying only related to running or their sport, that kind of depression?
Well, the separating the two out can be very difficult, and the extent to which people, I mean, the loss of a loved one might be easy. You might be able to regulate that through exercise, through the intensity of the exercise. You actually focus all your mind on something else. When someone's down about their job, for example, or stressed about their partner, and they have recurrent thoughts of that during the sport, and that has waves of negativity ongoing and intermittently, then the two things become embroiled, because you're down about your job and then your performance dips because you're not concentrating on it. Your concentration is overwhelmed by trying to think about too many things, and it just becomes very negative.
And what could be the, I know it's not an easy solution, but what would you recommend for someone who's maybe experiencing that right now?
I mean, I think everybody needs a bag of tricks to try and identify the dark moments that come in, and they all come in sport and they come in life. And so that, and have strategies to regulate their mood on an ongoing basis. And we talk of exercise as runners and as sports people, we try to achieve goals. But you can use exercise to actually improve your mood by getting out and going for a run in a fantastic environment. Going for a run, listening to a really interesting podcast in a really interesting environment. In my mornings, I've taken up with a very gentle jog and some, because I have a sore knee now, some circuit training, but around a very nice picturesque pool, listening to nice stuff. Mm-hmm. Or your podcast, I mean, not to suck up too much, but one of them. It's done intentionally that it actually sets the day up so I'm not in a bad mood. If I don't exercise in the morning, I can get myself into a bad mood. And if you are very keen on achieving a certain goal and you don't think you're going to get there and start overanalyzing it about where you're going to be and stuff like that, then it's needing strategies to bring that back to what you actually can do. Mm-hmm. Being very specific in your, one of the psychological skills we try to teach people is being in the here and now, be able to not get overwhelmed by the certain goal they're trying to achieve in terms of the outcome, and be very good at mentally sticking to what they're doing at that moment and doing the best they can at that moment. I mean, Chrissy Weddington's interview and all her interviews emphasize that point so much that she doesn't talk about this, how long it's going to be to get to the end, but the best you can be is the best you can be at that moment. Mm-hmm. You focus in on that moment and you do, and that takes care of it.
So let's unpack that a little bit. And Helen, I'd love to hear your thoughts afterwards as well on this, but a lot of us end up in the kind of state where we are running for a fear of failure. Like you just mentioned, you have a big goal, you have something that you really want, but then somewhere along the line, it gets kind of lost what the goal is. And suddenly you just don't want to fail anymore. You don't want to miss it. You know, I don't want to let people down. I don't want people to think I'm slow. I don't want, and all this kind of, negativity that comes around. So kind of explain to us, you know, for someone who might think, well, what's wrong with kind of not wanting to fail? I mean, maybe that motivates me. What is wrong with kind of thinking that way?
Oh, nothing. Okay. Nothing at all. That's your emotions their evolutionary function is to tell you what's important. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you define yourself as a runner and that's important to you, and you set a goal to do something that is important to you, then emotions will come, and those emotions will tell you it's important. And then what that will do is it'll fire up all the physiological systems ready for action. But they fire randomly sometimes. You're not ready to manage all that at any one point, and therefore it can feel overwhelming, feeling that you're not ready. So it's kind of accepting you're going to get those emotions, either letting them pass or thinking ways in which you can make that task achievable, which is often focusing on what is under your control and doing that the best way as possible, mm-hmm. accepting some of the limitations.
I think sometimes, even if you're slower like me, you want to succeed. If you've got your life is like this and there's certain parts of your – every other bit of your life is very depressing, then usually running is quite a good thing. It enhances your mood and that. And so if you're injured or you're not doing very well, that's your last thing lying in bed at night that you're not very good at. That's what I always find, that if anything, I can still run and be better at that. And so when you're injured, that's quite hard. And feeling a failure, and even on my level, if you were to go and say the London Marathon, you've told all those people that you're going to do it, and you've told, and people ask, what time are you going to do? Even if you're slow and say, I want to do it in under 4.5, or I want to do it in under 4 or 3.5, you know in your head that's put you under pressure. And I mean, why did you? We're competitive. Human beings are competitive. So we've competed with ourselves by saying that, mm-hmm. and so I don't know. We can easily think we're failures, can't we?
You can. I mean, the struggle, the difficult bit is with the goals of time-based goals. Is the variance is by weather conditions and course conditions. You know, if you're running around a track and you run around the same track, you could have a pretty good idea what the variance is like in the weather. But for most of the runners we meet and work with, they pick courses they barely know. Mm. On terrain they don't really know, on weather conditions they don't really know. I've done the same park run, I don't know, 260 times. And I know that the same effort can produce 30 seconds difference in performance. That is a really good observation for me in knowing how to judge the time, because previously 30 seconds you go, oh, gosh, poor, that's weak, I want to do this, and so on. But knowing what you can't control, the bad weather, therefore having ways to judge that performance, which are about how much effort you put in the here and now, is really important. Mm-hmm. This sort of the powers of reflection of replaying a race in your mind and going, okay, which part in the race did I really back off the effort because I just couldn't be bothered to? For most people, there aren't huge, great gaps where they just say, I'll just turn the accelerator down or walk because I was bored. They've run quite hard for most of it, and it doesn't matter what the speed is. They still run quite hard, and therefore they should be able to feel pleased with the fact that if you measured it by the intensity of the effort from start to finish, they're pretty good at that. And mm-hmm. I mean, marathons are really difficult to pitch the effort.
Saying that, out of people I know, even the good elite ones, and I'm just thinking in mind some elite ones we know, they are never happy.
Oh yeah.
And I say to them, such and such, you must be really pleased with that. You know, you did sub 2:30 for a marathon. And he said, no. He said, I could have done. I said, that's a PB, you know. And he said, oh, I feel I could have gone better, you know, in that mm-hmm. last bit. I could have gone better or something. So, yeah, I think the best are the hardest on themselves. And mm-hmm. I don't think they ever, ever, ever are pleased enough with themselves, ever.
Do you think it is even just the elite? Because, you know, I feel like plenty of people listening, and Helen, you interestingly put yourself, you've said a few times that you're slow, which I would have thought you as a psychologist would have been like, you know, we don't use those terms. Like, I'm always telling people that, you know, that doesn't matter. But either way, like, I know people, you know, who run 5-hour marathons, who run 2.5-hour marathons, everything in between. And they all have that saying, well, I could have done better, or I had something that goes wrong. Do you think it is kind of across the board?
Oh, yes, of course. Oh, it is. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, it is.
But absolutely. then I think across the borders, you know how you see confident people, and I've learnt this as I get older, everyone underneath has this underlining self-esteem. Yeah. They're not confident in all situations. Yeah. Yes, that they have this front, and you don't know it, do you?
The people are fragile. And I think most people try pretty hard in most efforts. So Park Run's really good because it's supposed to be not a right race, but it is. Yeah. And the even when you go slow for you, even when you go at the back, you still get a sense of real great competition, sense of competition, and how hard people will try to over those last parts. And they really do push themselves. And that is, in some ways, they push themselves much harder because they actually don't know what the effects will be of keeping to push because it's earlier in the training process.
Park runs are these free 5K runs.
Yeah. I've done a few of them, but we have had Paul Sinton Hewitt on, so most people listening should know. And if you haven't, then listen to Chrissy Wellington's episode or Paul Sinton Hewitt. So, yeah. But I think that's good that you explained about parkrun because you're right that should be the ultimate kind of just go out there and enjoy it. But even that people can't take very easily. And you know, before we go on, I want to kind of dive deeper into this. But Helen, I would love to kind of, before we get any further in, talk about, you know, you've done you've got your PhD and you mostly focus on attitudes towards eating among exercises, which is very interesting because I know this is a topic that is so touchy, very relevant to all runners. So tell us firstly, like, what is your work involved when it comes to, you know, like you said, eating among exercises? What do you do there with that?
Well, to take my PhD, what it was developing a tool to measure eating disorders and then applying that tool to people to develop strategies to improve their eating habits. And what I found was generally everyone, even though you fill in questionnaires, you know, you like to show yourself in a favourable light. Mm-hmm. Generally, everybody has a little bit of emotional problems with their eating. Yeah. They eat when they're stressed. They eat when they're bored. They eat not when they're hungry. They may overeat in social settings, all of that. So people think, you've got an eating disorder when, you know, you might be a specific psychiatric case. But it's generally not that. It's from what I saw and from what I found in my research is we all have this awareness of food now. It's almost the preoccupation with food, if you like. Mm-hmm. We almost now wake up in the morning and think about food to the moment we go to bed, mm-hmm. and assessing or thinking about what we eat and trying not to eat. As we eat things, if we eat processed cakes and all that, we're feeling guilty at mm-hmm. the same time of liking the food we eat. Mm-hmm. And I think, personally, it's with people who have had eating disorders, they never get over. And that will be with them for life. But the knowledge of knowing that everyone has it, almost. Everyone, from what I think, what about you, Andy? As an ex-boxer, are you aware of your eating all the time?
A lot of sports that emphasise leanness, where weight making and body issues as an influence on performance, most of the athletes have got detailed knowledge of food and ways to manipulate diet in order to try to improve performance and can create obsessional behaviours around food. There's a whole series of beliefs in each of those sports that are massively different, that drive behaviours. And, it, you know, eating is a biological thing that you need to keep alive. It's connected to great social occasions such as Christmas when you overeat. And so it's really hard to control those competing forces to how to eat properly. I mean, if I look at social media, I would not know what to eat. Whether if I'm going to go and have a piece of bread, I'm thinking the low carb, high fat police will come out the cupboards and arrest me.
Which is
When we were younger, I mean, my mother just said, "No, you can't have anything until your dinner because you'll lose your appetite or you'll ruin dinner or don't eat sweets because you'll wreck your teeth," and things like that. And I was thinking back, when was the first time you actually realised there was a link to eating and gaining weight? And I didn't even know until I was about 9. I didn't even think that putting food in my mouth, sweets, would make me fat. What about you? When was the first time you thought?
What you've got to remember is that my dad was a boxer as well. So So we would be watching boxing fights, and we'd watch the people who have strained down, and we'd the details Roberto Duran has come down from a stone over his weight in a short period of time, was rife in our family. So slightly different.
Yeah, and that's I think it really is interesting that you know, your family can have such a big influence. And I've had a lot of guests on the show who, Candace Huffin, who was on a few months ago, she talked about, she's a model, but considered a curvy or plus size model. But she kind of said that her mother was very much kind of, it is what it is, you know, I am what I am. Mm-hmm. But then you see other people who are very much, it is kind of a pressure, and it is something people think about, especially with mothers kind of talking badly about themselves. But how much of this is actually related to performance? Like, Helen, from what you've found, does performance and, like Andy said, it being the type of sport that, you know, emphasizes leanness, does that make a difference, or does it go so far beyond that it becomes more than just performance?
My mother used to run marathons, and my mother was bulimic. She's still bulimic. She's about 80-something, 85. And so she must weigh about 6.5 stone, 7 stone.
Which I think is about 80 pounds, if I have that right.
She's just skin and bones, and she's always just been skin and bones. And so for my whole childhood, from when I was 8, 9, 10, I was always used to seeing bits of sick in the toilet floating on the top. I was always seeing, she used to have nothing, like coffee all day, come home from her day's work. Well, first of all, she'd go out for like a 12-mile run. She'd come back. She'd cook us kids a fry-up. Then she'd get ready for work. Then she'd bike to work, which was about 6 miles. And then she'd bike back. And I think she just had coffee at work, because this is what she was like later. And then when she came back, she used to have piles and piles of cakes from the cake shop, and pies, you know, and she used to eat the whole lot. So that was her. And she did marathons, but I don't know what came, in her case, what came first, because there was no competitive, she's a competitive person, and she did exercise, and none of us was concerned about weight. Mm-hmm. She was never overweight. Mm. She has like a manic personality.
Yeah, another I think you're saying is that people can have strange or different eating habits, and have if they have a resilience to that and an approach to managing it, then their performance won't dip. Mm-hmm. And so if it's consistent, habitual, and you get used to it, you can cope with it, which is, I mean, there's some boxers who've become like that as Ricky Hatton would be 3 stone over his fighting weight 12 weeks to the fight, and then on the fight he's looking fit. He's the reality is that people have trained for 12 weeks without eating much, you can't have eaten much food to shift that much energy. And so people get resilient in their mindset, get used to exercising hungry, get used to exercising hard, hungry and tired.
Yeah, yeah.
And learn to adapt to that. Now, I mean, the science around that is, you know, would they have gone better if they'd have eaten more? Most likely, but there isn't much evidence because studies haven't been conducted. And for every point you throw, well, if you add more food, you'd have greater strength. Someone will counterclaim that is the dieting gave me a mental toughness, which might be the case. And it certainly is how they attribute it. But, you know, it's one of those things where the performance is often the messy end to it. If you said to someone, if you restrict your diet, what will your emotional control be like? And he'll tell you what, if you want to find an angry person, find a hungry person. If you want to get someone angry, you know, if you want to do interventions to make people emotional, holding back on sleep and food would be two easy ways to do it. And so if you're in any activity where emotions come in surges, and you know, try making a very delicate decision about pace or about responding to someone or responding to when you're in an angry state, you're not good at it. So there would be one way in which diet wouldn't have really beneficial effects. And there would be a whole series of others in that there'd be strength parts where your movement would reduce in its efficiency. And you might overcome that with greater effort, but in the long term, I don't think that's a good thing.
Yeah, and it's such a like tricky topic, and I plan on kind of diving into this connection between eating and performance, and just how like tangled up our running is for all of us. As you mentioned, Helen, it'd be hard to find someone who didn't have some kind of level of issue with it. But you know, I want to get through some other things with both of you, because I think there's a lot we can talk about here. But as you are both runners, you know, you've obviously understood the struggles that we go through, the negative thoughts that come through, these emotions that kind of tell us, you know, not good things. We don't feel good. For someone listening, you've worked with the elite level and all the way through the recreational side, can we ever truly stop these negative thoughts coming through our minds? I just want you to kind of explain it, as you have worked with everyone, as you understand this, you know, what can we do with these negative thoughts that come into our mind as we get tired?
And straight answer, can you stop them? No.
Yeah.
No.
That's what I wanted you to say. It's just them. Yeah.
The way to stop them is take it very, very lightly. You can stop it doing that way. If you're actually pushing hard, what will happen is the harder your exercise will come, there'll come a point where it starts to physically hurt. Mm-hmm. When it starts to physically hurt, alongside that will be negative thoughts that will say, why don't you slow down? Why don't you slow down? Mm-hmm. That physiology will translate itself in a dialogue that says, slow down, slow down. And it'll start presenting, you don't really want to do, you don't really want to do this. It might start presenting, you might get an injury. And all those things will start. Will send in thoughts. I think it's a really good strategy to do sessions which get yourself to that intensity that bring on those negative thoughts.
But then you pull in the thoughts of, like in my case, Andy said I can do it. He said don't think so negatively. He said you. He has said to me, you've done it before, and everything like that. So those are my thoughts inside that I will pull on, and then I will remember what race that I did them before in and things like that.
Yeah.
And so you can, in a sense, especially when you've got those prepared in your head, you've got to have...
They're still coming. The negative thoughts are still coming, but the strategies you've got to use against them can be ingrained, so yeah. When they come, you manage it. You won't. It'll come. So the one of them you've just said is performance reminder. So when it comes, okay, can I keep this going? Do I need to slow down, or can I keep this going? And the answer to that can be yes. Mm. And you know, it's the condition your body, condition your mind sometimes is quite a good way of doing that. Is treadmill running. It's a bit boring, but whereas on running on the road, your running determines the pace. If you crank the treadmill up to 15K an hour and have to stay on it for a certain number, for as long as you like, can you? The next question is, well, could you go 1 second longer? 1 second longer. If you give a bit run, can you go 1 second longer? And you go, and the answer will be always yes.
Except the one thing is, I was just thinking about that. It's got to matter to you, doesn't it?
It's got to matter to you, yeah.
It's got to be, there's got to be a challenge in front of you. It's got to be something you really want to do, not something that I just say, can't be bothered.
So will you share some strategies with us? You just mentioned the treadmill there, Andy, that, you know, running on the treadmill can kind of force you to face some of those thoughts. But what else can someone listening do? I mean, Helen mentioned that she'll hear your voice in her head. And, you know, I have said many times that I hear my husband's voice in my head. But what can someone listening do? Maybe their significant other isn't anything to do with running. Or what other strategies can we use to override those thoughts when they come in?
Okay, let's take them. First one would be to you could rethink what fatigue means, starting point. So fatigue is an indicator that you're working hard. It's not to be feared. It's accepted that it's going to be working hard. And we're working with a marathon runner and going into an important race. And the idea that it's going to be hard from the start because the pace you're going is never easy. It's not as in the sense that it's going to be just first bit be jogging along. Sub 6 minute miles always feels quite hard. So when you want to go that quick, you've got to be fairly on the pace quite on, and there'll be physiological symptoms that say that hurts quite a bit. You just reappraise that and rethink that as that is normal.
So is that kind of you saying, okay, I'm feeling tired. That's good. That means I'm trying hard and that means I'm doing the right thing. Okay.
Yeah. And then it's playing around with the words you say to yourself, and if that can be awfully negative. And then it's writing statements down that you might want to say to yourself. And they may be motivational, I can do it, and all those things. But and they're quite useful to use when your self-talk is excessively negative. Mm-hmm. And you can put those into something called if-then plans. So and you write them down beforehand. So if I start saying I want to stop that now, then I'll remind myself why I'm doing it, and I'll say to myself, just keep going. Say that to yourself out loud three times, and that will the sentence you want to be in your mind is likely to be there if that first thought comes into your head. So you won't forget it on the day because you pre-programmed it in. And then, so these are the ones I think are most effective are using things like imagery so that you've got an image of a smooth movement. So that instead of trying to try harder, you put your mind into the process of running and try to run more smoothly. And a lot of the work we do is to try and get people to know what their pace is and to have a really good internal set of feelings to what that's like and be able to turn that around without having to look at their watch. And so we get them to do things like imagery, and that can be using imagery of a very good runner. So you go, which runner do you see as perfect? Who you want to emulate? And we find that, and then we typically find a video of it and get them to watch their feet. And then, having watched their feet, we get them to then imagine those feet going round. And then, so when you're next running, is imagine those feet going round. Imagine those feet as your feet going round. Sink your feet into those feet you put in your head. So you've got this image of feet running and you're synchronising your feet into those feet, of those smooth feet running round. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you've got a smooth, rhythmical, fast thing in your mind rather than how hard I'm pushing, rather than all the language and breathing that's going on. You're just concentrating on this smooth action.
So just replaying
that? And that is a really effective one. Replaying it, yeah.
Okay.
Feet is really good for that. And it's quite easy to do because you just pick a video from YouTube of someone you like and watch it.
How long should you watch it for? Like, is it something you should do every day in the month before, or how often should we be doing this?
Get the image that you want to use. Get about 20 seconds of it that you want to image, because it's not a math test. You know, it's not something hard to... You just want one image that you can have in your mind really clearly, and just get... Watch it, then close your eyes, replay it in your mind. Watch it again, close your eyes, replay it in your mind. Try and see as many things in that image that were there. So what the colour of the shoes, what the colour of the socks, what the colour of the things going around, and what the sounds, mm-hmm. so that you are getting good at replaying that in its exactness, and use that at points either prior to the start of the race when you want to get that smooth feeling that everything's going to go quite well. That image is your smoothest part of your go-to set of feelings. At a point where you lose rhythm, going up hills, feeling quite tired, pushing quite hard, that is a go-to thing to try and get your rhythm back. There's other ways of doing that. Another way I think is simple within race is to look at the runner ahead of you and sink your feet into what they're doing, and put a mental loop between their foot and your foot, and try and synchronize your movements into their movements. Because there's some lovely work from rowing particularly, where based on what seems to be an evolutionary principle, that humans like to synchronize their actions with each other. So if one person runs, the other one runs, it feels easier to run on your own. So synchronizing your foot to the other person's foot as a means to try and put a loop around it to make it going around is a really nice thing to do, and one that can be practiced in running sessions. So if you're in a running group, or you're in any run you're with, and people in front of you around about your pace, it's put a mental loop around their feet, so their feet are running your feet.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. I haven't heard of that. Yeah. No, that's great. Helen, anything you'd add?
No.
Okay. All right. Let's
not carried away there.
No, it was very interesting to hear about, and good advice there.
You could do music as well.
Music?
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about that for a second. You know, I'm always telling people not to run with music, that they need to learn to, you know, trust their body, and it will tell them, and they should be concentrating on kind of feeling smooth and just listening to what their body's saying. But I did read on your website that you have some information about running helping. So what are your thoughts on running with music?
The music is quite good in that same way as synchronizing your foot to the beat. So if you want to, push you along, the idea that you just synchronize the runs, the stride rate to the beat can be a really good way. It's like a coach just tapping out the rhythm. You just sink it into the rhythm. If you can get at the start of races when runners are a bit nervous, the tendency is to over egg it, and when they've not got headphones on, to sing the song as they start as a way to not go out too quickly is a really good way of holding back the pace.
So sing it in your head?
Sing it in your head, yeah.
Okay. And a song?
Sounds a bit odd.
No.
Any song you like, really. I mean, songs are so personal. What you want is the right rhythm. So what you want is a right rhythm. You'd practiced it, run it before. If it was me, I would be listening to some sort of horrible punk band from the late 70s, early 80s, of which no one else would like. So if I say that, it will just immediately alienate the whole audience.
I listen to either Harry Potter books sometimes. If you go out on a long trot. What's that?
Racing.
While you're racing?
Oh, no, not racing, nothing like that. But you know how you have to do an 18-miler? You've either got to do... So I put things like Shrek songs and things like that from movies that I really liked, because it lets me drift into thinking about them. But all I have to do is get the 18-miler done, and not at a particular speed. That doesn't mean I'm listening to the music the whole time, because when you get tired, you don't listen to it. Or Harry Potter, I really love Harry Potter. And so at least it gets me out the door and at least I can go along. But after a while, I'm not listening at all.
That's for long, slow runs.
Yeah, long, slow, or just to get you out the door in the morning. Mm-hmm. Never for a park run, never for any races, not much at all.
Okay. I advise people to run, not in races, not music. You've got to learn to tune to your body. Absolutely, I agree with that completely.
Okay.
But it's a tool you can use occasionally.
Okay, in training. Okay. All right, and then let's talk about after the race. We hear a lot about post-race blues and people kind of feeling like, you know, let's go through two scenarios. You have a good race, you felt good, you felt strong, you ran a big PB, PR, and you want to get back to it because you're excited and you feel good. But I've always felt that emotionally you kind of almost need a reset to kind of... because you put so much intensity into your training and your goal. So tell us about a good race, you know, people want to get back to it quickly, or a bad race where they want to get back to it because they want to kind of prove themselves and they want to get back to showing that they haven't lost it, in quotes. So tell us about, you know, after a race and the different emotional states that we can be going through there.
One of the best ways to regulate your negative emotions from a bad race is to go and do another one. So for all of previously with, say, marathons, the idea that you can only, the mindset is going back 10 years, that you can only do so many a year. So if you did one, you have to have a long rest. And it's not quite the same now, so people would do them. And therefore, if you have a bad race because of bad weather or you didn't quite get it right, so it's quite a good strategy. Say, I'll do another one in 15 weeks' time. Because what that does, it gives you enough time to have a bit of a rest, and then the act of forward planning is actually quite good for your mood because you've got something to aim at. And so forward planning as a strategy for mood change is good. Whether that's to book another race, another good strategy for forward planning is called booking a holiday, by the way. Something to look forward to. Something to look forward to, holiday, look forward to boost your mood. And where your self-esteem is tied in to race performance, then it's a good idea to actually then to enter something again, rest a little bit at the start, give yourself enough time, and then the act of planning, reflecting on what you did previously is usually quite helpful. And quite often people start from a good physical base because unless they're injured, to be able to go through that. And we talked about emotions being hard to control, but when you do badly, the anticipation that you're going to do badly again, that brings back that wave of unpleasant emotions. Mm. And what that can do is say, well, actually, this training session we said you're going to go out slow is good for your training because it helps you recover. So you better go and do it because last time you missed something like that. You might reflect on, last time you didn't push hard enough in the hard sessions, or there will be bits in that analysis of your training block that you could say, I could have done this better or differently. And it often, in most training, is that the typical is they blob all their training together. The easy stuff gets a bit too hard, and the hard stuff is done under being a bit too tired. Mm-hmm. And so emotions can come in and help people make much better decisions.
So what about someone who is listening and they're saying, you know, I had a bad race recently and you said wait 15 weeks, but I can't afford to wait 15 weeks. I want to try and race again in 3 weeks, 4 weeks. Is that a good idea emotionally?
I mean, I'm in a marathon. Yeah, I don't think it's a bad idea. I think that it depends on how long. I meant that really in reference to marathon running.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I'm talking about.
15
as well.
Weeks. You need a physical recovery. For most people, they can overcome that in a few days. Then they build back into it again. I don't see how quick there aren't any set rules to how fast you repair emotionally. If you really want to go and run and want to go and race, and then you have the appetite for that, and that will drive you when you want to do it. And I don't think there's not a rule to that. There's not a rule to that. And so, but there would be a rule. There would be, I mean, you'd expect there to be some physical differences to require some rest. But you look at, remember Graham Obrey when he tried the hour record? He failed one day. They booked the track, and they'd only booked the track for 24 hours. And he worked out that, well, if he gets down there at 11 or something the next day, he'd still got the track for another hour. So he tried the hour record on one day and missed it. He was so angry. He said, right, and he spent all night thinking, and then, right, I'm doing it tomorrow morning. And he got up and did it, and he went and broke the hour record. And his mindset was, I have now committed to doing this, and there's nothing going to stop me from doing this. I know it's going to hurt, and so that's part of the deal, but I know it's going to hurt, and I accept all of that, and therefore I'm going to do it. And that is the recovery from, I mean, Graham Obrey has some demons, but the sense of recovery, that was arguably, that's a very good strategy for doing it, because he suddenly realised what he needed to do, and he was prepared to do what he wasn't prepared to do the day before.
Okay.
Rushed it through, though.
Yeah.
Much harder when you do better, though, but much harder when you've had a good event, and the idea that you will repeat that every single time is much more difficult, mm-hmm. because you kind of it's very difficult to get from the very highs, isn't it, to maintain those highs, and it is advisable to have a break, because it is unlikely that you're going to have another Olympic gold medal winning moment. Appearing 2 months later, you know, after the great event, and it's at the point where you really do need to dig in. It's much harder to then dig in that deeply again, mm-hmm. because your hunger has been satisfied quite a lot by the previous one. So it's having a bit of a rest helps restoke those fires. When I've worked in boxing, where is very emotionally charged, where the cost of winning and losing over 45 minutes is life-changing, far more than any other event I've ever been in. And the idea that those people are then going back into that competitive environment again is not advisable. Mm-hmm. We like to keep them fit, so the strategy after that would be to try and get them on other sports. So when I've worked with boxers, we've then gone mountain biking. And within a few days of that, because people are competitive, if you're racing up a hill, they want to race just as much as anyone else. You can find a competitive spirit, but it helps to do it in areas where your self-esteem isn't so tightly managed by the outcome.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for explaining that, and that's helpful. Okay, we're just going to take a moment to thank our sponsors, and we'll be back with the Running for Real 4.
You obviously love podcasts, right? You wouldn't be here otherwise. And as this is a bonus episode, I wanted to let you know about something else I have related to podcasts. If you love podcasts, you might enjoy my Running for Real podcast series. Now, I have 6 different series. I'm going to tell you a little bit about each in just a second. But what are these? These series are 6 to 7 episodes about a specific topic that you might be interested in. And they have some of the best experts from all over the world who are here to give you specific advice on these topics. Along with that, you get a 15 to 20 page printout guide that you can use, and it has referrals from people, it has suggestions, it has tips from these experts that are not included in the interview. I bugged the heck out of them to make sure they gave me good advice. And if you haven't already checked out the podcast series, if you are a newer listener, or if you are someone who just got a little bit busy when it came time to check these out earlier in the year, I just wanted to remind you about them. So I do have a beginner runner podcast series, a coming back from injury. So that one is especially important if you are struggling with an injury, especially as we focus on the emotional and the mental side of injuries. On that note, I have a mental training series. If you are preparing for a race and the mental side of your running is what kind of holds you back, definitely want to be checking that one out. There is a nutrition podcast series where we kind of look into all the different viewpoints of people who are experts in the industry, so you can make your own mind up about what is the best nutritional path for you. There is a marathon podcast series. I don't have to explain that one. I think you kind of get what that one is. And finally, there is a running through and after pregnancy podcast series. If you are thinking about getting pregnant or if you are pregnant, or even if you're postpartum, this is really going to help you. I get all the answers to all the questions. Now, on that note, I made sure each of these episodes are focused on a specific topic within that category. Really, really detailed. I'm really proud of these series. Priced them way too low, so you're going to get them at a steal, and I cannot guarantee they're always going to be at the price they are right now. So head on over to tinamuir.com and head to the podcast tab. You will see them right there. Hope you enjoy. Thanks so much.
All right, Helen, Andy, I have four more questions for you. I think I'm going to do one each, so you guys can choose between you who answers each one. But firstly,
we've been looking at these, haven't we?
You've been looking at them? Okay, well, yeah, then you know what's coming.
We've been umming and ahhing all afternoon over how these go.
All right, so who has a photo to share that might not be quite what it seems?
Well, quite a lot of the photos we have in running races, and they have us running together. Mm-hmm. Now, whilst that look, that might give the impression that we've run around together. That isn't quite the case, because in quite a few races, I've worked out where the race photographer is and then walk back to the race photographer, waited for Helen, and then run through the race photographer, still with my number on as I'm in the race, and then stop about 30 metres after the other side, just so we get a photo together.
So wait, you finish the race first and then go back, or do you kind of go back within the race? Afterwards,
oh, no, I typically finish the race. Oh no, I'm not saying that. I'm not that good a husband.
So then you've got two sets of race photos. You've got the ones with Helen, and then the ones on your own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you like it? Yeah.
Well, there you go. You're getting your money's worth.
Ones aren't important. No. You don't have to pay for them.
Yeah. You do over here in the US. It's very rare to get race photos without paying for them. Okay, let's move on. Helen, maybe you can answer this one, a running for real moment for us.
Oh, running for real. My only moment the moment that I liked best was simply getting under 4 hours for me, which is a fantastic time, even though I've got 3:59 for a marathon, 3:57.
Yeah.
But I was over 50, so I meant I got good for age for London.
Yeah,
marathon.
That's huge. Yeah, congrats, definitely.
And you know, you apply to get in the ballot, you never get in. You apply, you never get in. You apply, you never get in. Everyone seems to want to go into London Marathon, and if you do, under 4 hours as a over 50-year-old, then you can get in. So I can remember running along in Manchester, and it was 3:54 was what I did. But Manchester Marathon, for 2 years in a row, was short.
Yeah.
And they sent you you heard about that. Uh-huh. It was very funny. And but also... But you see, at London Marathon, now I'll be 55 and over, and I only have to get 4:05. It's easy for anyone to get, isn't it? 4 hours.
No,
well, I don't know if that's easy for anyone. I think it's all kind of relative. We've got some people listening who would be absolutely over the moon with that once in their life. But that's really cool that you've been able to do that. And I'll be excited to hear how you get on in that one. Andy, will you share with us?
I thought she was going to tell us about the time at Parkrun where there was this controversy. There was a right hand turn, and beside the right hand turn there was a cone, but there were some cobbles, and there was talk that people were going over the cobbles. So a secret camera was placed on the corner. A secret camera was placed on the corner, only for it to be shared on social media of who had
cut the corner.
And then, of course, this is the time when there was a league table. And then they were saying, well, how many points should we deduct from people?
This was when it was small, and also we knew people.
The Cobblesgate affair raged on for a few weeks.
Anyway.
That's funny. Thank you. That's really cool for sharing. That's definitely a running for real moment. Only runners will get that. And finally, what do you both tell yourselves when you're standing on the start line?
Oh, I just think hurry up, start, because I'm nervous. And I know as soon as you start,
you'll feel better.
You're not nervous anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't like the 3 minutes. But I also tell myself I feel nervous, and that's great I don't like the feeling, because it means you don't have to do a warm-up. It means that your heart is racing, and that's like a warm-up in itself, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And it's doing all those things that a warm-up wouldn't do without you running. Isn't that right?
Yeah, no, it's all good.
And what do you tell yourself?
I always get to the front. That's the first part. I thought, well, I might as well get to the front. There's no point running any longer. And there are some funny pictures of me standing by some very, very athletic-looking Africans at the Belfast Marathon. It's only a run kind of thing, you know, not to over-egg it. And just set out with what the speed you're going to go at, which is always too hard.
What do you tell yourself?
I say, just enjoy it. That's usually what I say, because it's been a few years since I've raced now, so I had to think about that. But I would say something along the lines of, you know, all you can do is your best, just enjoy it. Well, thank you for asking that. And finally, okay, just to wrap up here, how can people find out more about you? Where can we find you on social media, on your website? Just for people, I will have links in the show notes, but just so they, if they're listening, where can they go find you both?
Oh, well, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Run Helen Lane.
Okay.
And I suppose that's it, really.
Twitter's best. I'm Andy Lane 27.
Okay, great. And I'll put links to your website as well. Is it the Winning Lane is the best place for them to go?
Winninglane.com is one, and winninglane.blog is another one.
Okay, great.
They both go. Okay.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Helen. Andy, it's been wonderful to talk to you. I've really appreciated your responses, the way you've helped us, and look forward to hearing more in the future. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks, Tina.
Thank you.
Lots of insight there, and a lot of what they talk about had been things I'd wondered for many years, but I thought maybe I was the only one that thought about that. Obviously not. I want to take a moment to thank all the supporters and sponsors of me and Running for Real through Patreon. You are the reason this episode is here, and you will now have a bonus episode every month for your generosity and support. If you appreciate all that I do for Running for Real, you can find links in the show notes along with everything else we talked about, including Helen's eating attitude test and some slideshows from talks Andy has given in the past. You can find that at tinamuir.com/bonus3, because technically this is the third bonus episode. Did you know that? On Friday this week, we have an episode with Derek Murphy of Marathon Investigation, and it's going to be a bit of a different one. We're kind of exploring what Derek does in kind of outing cheaters, but you're going to hear that it's not actually as bad as it sounds. It's not just focusing on negativity. Derek is coming from a good place, and it was really interesting for me to learn more about what he does. So be sure to subscribe if you haven't already, and you can find out more about that on Friday. I hope you have a great, start to your week this time. It's not the end of the week. I hope you have a great week, and I'll see you Friday.
Thanks for listening to the Running for Real podcast. Be sure to check out tinamuir.com for show notes and even more helpful running information.